It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore legislative efforts to legalize skateboarding on Wisconsin roads with the reintroduction of a bill. Call in with your question, share concerns about skateboards, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Marsha Hovey is president of the Osceola Skate Park Project in Osceola. Marsha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes, and Scott May here as well, writer in the Madison area and a skateboarder. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Scott, let's start with you. Since 1984, Wisconsin state law has included skateboards on this list of, air quotes here, play vehicles prohibited on roads. Also in the category are unicycles, roller skates, sleds, toboggans, and toy vehicles on which a person can ride. And you support this bill that would remove skateboards from that list. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand the culture that's built up around skateboarding and the kind of kids it attracts at an early age. And really what we're talking about here with this bill in particular is giving municipalities the ability to regulate how skateboards are used on municipal roads. Because what the bill actually does, in fact, is give skateboards the same exception that rollerblades got in the 90s when that sort of fad kicked up, which is to take them off the play vehicle list and allow municipalities to decide when and where they would be safe to use on roadways. So for me, it's important for this bill because, you know, with skateboarding and the culture and the way it is, you know, having in the back of your head as like a 12 or 13 year old just trying to push your skateboard to and from school on your safe residential road that, you know, you're in violation of. You might know, you might not know, but you know in the back of your head instinctually, like, you're always in danger of being stopped and questioned and asked why you're doing what you're doing, which is, in fact, just a healthy outdoor activity.
Marsha, advocates of legal skateboarding may say if your city doesn't have a skate park, then your city is a skate park. How does that statement apply to Osceola, where you live?
Yeah, Tony Hawk is famous for saying that, and it could not be more true. Skateboarders will always find places to skate. And if you build it, they will come. Could never be more true for the skateboarding community. So for Osceola and a lot of rural communities within Wisconsin and even some urban communities, the lack of a skate park really leads to this conflict that Scott is talking about, where you're getting in trouble for skating in some area that you're not supposed to, when the solution for a lot of people is a free public skate park, which are really lacking in Wisconsin. So our initiative is to build a free public concrete skate park right within an existing park system for everyone to enjoy.
And the skate park fundraising page, you know, that is underway as well. And I think your story goes for well over a decade, residents of Osceola have dreamed of a skate park. What has that journey been like to try to make this a reality?
For so many towns, there is this age-old story of a community that has tried and tried for 10 years, some 20 years, to no avail to get a skate park. It really takes a dedicated community to fundraise and to keep going and keep going and keep asking, because the state has not yet really recognized skate parks as they do field sports and investing in track and field, investing in basketball courts. So I moved to this area about 3 years ago. I am the marketing director at Trollhagen Ski Area, which attracts a lot of talent locally and even internationally for snowboarding and terrain parks. And when I moved to the area, I questioned why we didn't have a skate park and found out that I was not the only one with this question. And about 10 years ago, there was an effort and it just kind of stalled out. So we picked it up about 2.5 years ago and have been really, really steadfast at raising funds. And we are now at about $81,000 of our $200,000 goal for Osceola Skate Park Phase 1.
Phase one. Marcia Hovey there with Osceola Skate Park Development Project, leading that effort. Scott May, a skateboarder in the Madison area. You can join in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. Scott, you mentioned fines and current state law and local ordinances result in skateboarders getting tickets or having to pay fines. How does treating skateboarding as a crime affect people who like to do it?
And this is an interesting question, and one I think that is very, very, very important. And the first thing to understand is that the enforcement of these skateboarding regulations, especially skateboarding on the street, seems to be spotty at best and situational, and also, it just doesn't seem to be uniform in any way. So essentially what this law allows law enforcement to do is to either, pick out the one problem person they just want to, sort of deal with, or have enforcement events where they just, blanket give out warnings or blanket give out tickets. And this really results in an effect on the community in that there becomes a distrust. And I said it in an op-ed I wrote, and I really do believe it, that if you want to change, if you want these kids to stop behaving as if they're outlaws, the first step is to probably stop treating them like they're outlaws. We're living in a time where skateboarding is an Olympic sport, where the biggest sponsors in the area in the sphere are Nike and New Balance and Adidas. We're talking about a uniquely American sport that started in the 1940s, and there is absolutely no reason there needs to be this animosity surrounding it. And, just giving skateboarders the same rights as, say, a rollerblader would have to safely traverse State Street in Madison without worry of getting a ticket or being stopped, I think it is an important step in mainstreaming the culture, but also recognizing we're already in your state. We're already residents. We've been here for years, and we're obviously not going anywhere. And these prohibitive laws have obviously not worked. So there has to be a better way to deal with this.
Are there persistent, stubborn stereotypes that have continued with skateboarding? And what are those stereotypes like?
Well, I'm going to give you a story. So Cottage Grove built a skate park. It opened a couple weeks ago, and it's a wonderful skate park. And it's how I like to see a skate park being built. It's within an already defined park that has baseball fields, splash pads. It has playground equipment. So it's integrated. In short, it's integrated into the community, right? It's integrated into where people are already congregating to do things. It's not shoved off into some industrial corner where all you have to look at is the lead reclaiming bin around you. You have nice trees and rolling hills, very beautiful space to be in. So I'm skating it the other week, and I see it's on like sort of a rural road. So I just push out into the rural road and see some painted curbs, and I'm like, oh, those could be interesting. I wonder if skaters are going to end up skating those a little bit, because that's kind of what we do. And I see a car sort of like a quarter mile down the road, and I'm like, all right. So I get out of the road, and As it's rolling by, he rolls down his window and he just screams at me, "Stay in your blankin' park," and then speeds off. And now, I don't know if that's due to persistent stereotypes. I don't know if that's due to a persistent portrayal as something is wrong with skateboarding. But this happened to me as a 40-year-old man. But the first time this happened to me, I was probably a 10 or 11-year-old kid. Hmm. And this is why I want to change this particular law in the state of Wisconsin, because the more you mainstream these things, the more you put us in sight of your community, the more people get used to us being there, the more we are allowed our space to exist in our own community with our own culture.
Thank you for sharing that story, skateboarder Scott May and skate park development president in Osceola, Marcia Hovey, here on efforts to change the law that makes it illegal to ride a skateboard on roads in Wisconsin. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We hear voices of support for a bill circulating in the state legislature to change the law that bans skateboards from Wisconsin roads. The legislation would allow local communities to decide how to regulate skateboards on their streets. And you can join in the discussion along the way. Call in with a question, share concerns, 800-642-1234. Skateboarder Scott May in Madison and Marcia Hovey, president of the Osceola Skate Park Project, stays with us. Let's bring in Jason now in Prairie du Chien. Jason, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm 35 now, but when I was in high school, we used to get into a lot of trouble for skateboarding on the road. You couldn't skateboard on the sidewalks. They'd give you fines or take your skateboard. And now our town has actually built a pretty decent skate park, and the changes have been just phenomenal. I mean, it's really the attitude towards skateboarding and kids being out there having fun, getting exercise has really improved.
Oh, so Jason, you have noticed a change in your community.
Correct.
Marcia, what do you make of that story?
That makes me so happy to hear. And we are starting to see such a high demand for physical skate parks. And they could range from prefab materials plopped on top of a piece of pavement near a tennis court, or it could be something much more grandiose and sculptural, costing up to, you know, millions of dollars, like we've seen in Des Moines. Scott mentioned skateboarding is now an Olympic sport, and Des Moines actually now has the largest skate park in America, which immediately after opening hosted the first ever Olympic trials for skateboarding, bringing in athletes from all over the world. And the more we see these skate parks popping up in the Midwest and in Wisconsin, the better it will be for the greater community. And like Jason said, this is an amazing opportunity for outdoor recreation in a time where we desperately need less screen time and more time outside, making friendships, making connections, having that face-to-face conversation, and getting outside and active.
Scott, when you're skateboarding, I wonder, like, where is your mind? I would imagine you have to really focus. Your mind can't really wander. You certainly can't, like, you know, check your phone. What happens to your mindset when you're on the skateboard?
This is a very important question for me in particular. I was diagnosed with ADHD in probably 1994, 95, somewhere in there. So my mind is typically on fire most all of the time. Mm. It's just a channel surf in there, running narrative and whatever else is going on. When I'm skating, like I said, I'm 40, so I drive to the park and it just turns everything off. And I got one thing to focus on. But more importantly for me in specific, I got a space where it is absolutely 100% okay for me to be impulsive and reckless within reason, if that makes sense.
Our skate parks, do they all have their own personalities, Scott? Do you find that they have different types of creativity?
I do. I really do. And I also find they send different messages about community priorities with their skateboarders, too. Because, like I said, Cottage Grove just built a beautiful park, and it's integrated within the community. Madison has a very beautiful park, a very big park. It's my home park. I love skating that park. But next to it, like I said, is, you know, a place where they dump reclaimed lead. And on the other side is a train track and a falling down storage unit facility, right? So they definitely have their different personalities. They definitely have different things they invoke, but they also send a message about what the city kind of view, how the city kind of views their skaters as well, if that makes sense.
Marcia, yes. How do other states support the building of skate parks? I mean, we hear Des Moines having this iconic skate park.
Yeah, the rest of the country is very interesting as to how they take on skate park projects. The West Coast and the mountain areas predictably spend a lot more money and attention in skate parks. Colorado, Montana, Oregon, California, Idaho, all of these states have really built skate parks into their lexicon for recreation. So you see a lot of skate parks popping up really quickly. And you don't have the army of community members that are raising money dollar by dollar. Instead, you have tax efforts that go directly to those skate parks being built. So for us in the Midwest, we're not quite there yet. Minnesota just passed a really great bonding bill that's dedicated a couple million dollars to the creation of skate parks, which is phenomenal and something that hopefully sets a standard and takes off in Wisconsin and other surrounding states.
That is Marcia Hovey with us from Osceola Skate Park President. And we have Madison area writer and skateboarder Scott May. You can join the conversation with your questions, 800-642-1234. Scott, circling back to the bill drafted by Democratic Representative Alex Jors and State Senator Chris Larson, would, you know, taking skateboards off the list of play vehicles prohibited on public roads, if the bill succeeds, though, municipalities could still restrict skateboarding. How then does that help skateboarders in communities where they are banned on city streets?
That's a great question. And I'd also like to point out, I have been told that the bill does enjoy bipartisan co-sponsorship in both the Senate and the Assembly. So there are Republicans on this bill in both houses, which is a great thing. Whenever you can get support across the aisle on an idea, it always has a better chance of making it forward in the process. But the important part of that question you asked is it allows the local skateboard community to deal with their local elected officials. And here's where it becomes very, very, very important, because I do honestly believe this. If you are a skate dad, a skate mom, a skate sibling, you have skateboarder friends or known anyone who gravitated to this sport and it gave them something to hold on to when maybe they were feeling isolated, this is when you need to call your representatives and say, you know, this prohibitive stuff has not worked. If we can integrate rollerblades onto residential and municipal roads, if we can integrate bikes, if you can go ahead and pass a law to make electronic scooters legal in 2019. And when's the last time you saw one of those just sort of zooming around, as, you know, if we're talking about fad vehicles? If we can do all of this stuff safely, we can integrate a group of kids who are outsiders who gravitate to an individual sport that allows for a sort of ultimate free expression and practitioner of it to be integrated into our broader society as well.
Let's go to John and Stevens Point. John, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I was going to say that I worked for many years, starting in the 80s, to get a skate park in Stevens Point. And then, as someone mentioned earlier, that those early pushes didn't really work so well. But when we finally did get a more organized push to come in 2010, it was well received by our community, and we got a great spot down by our river, unlike some of the like brownfield or unsavory sites that people tend to get. But it was really rewarding to see our community come behind it. One thing I thought was different from the early efforts than the later ones is that there really weren't a lot of parents involved. In fact, here in Stevens Point, there were none involved in the last push to get the skate park, the successful one, finally. Not that there's a correlation there, but I thought that was interesting, and I think it would really be helpful for if more parents could be involved, and maybe they are elsewhere. It was just could be an anomaly in Stevens Point. But
who then was the driving force in this successful effort then? As you say, parents weren't involved.
You know, it's weird because I was the only skateboarder really on the committee, and everyone else, they didn't even have kids that were skating age. They were just like people who saw a need, and I didn't even get involved initially because I thought it was going to fail, honestly, because I was already at that point almost 40. So, but I was wrong. And it was great to see these people who really had no skin in the game. And they're saying, I have skin in the game, please build a skate park for me. And it was really great to see that people rally behind this. And I would echo what the skateboarder said about just being able to have this outlet and growing up loving something, but sort of knowing that you're viewed as, by at least some in the law, in the eyes of the law, as a criminal, and that no one else has to deal with that.
John, I'm going to jump in here because I want just a few moments here for Marcia to respond to your story and the push that was successful, Marcia.
Yeah, it's so great to hear. And like he said, having those parents involved is wonderful. I am a skateboarder myself. I am not a parent. I really want this skate park for our community, but also for my own usage. And something I say at every event and every meeting I go to is you don't have to be a skateboarder to support public skate parks. It is so important to have people on our side and on our team that really see the positive effect of a skate park, whether or not they're going to use it. Skate parks provide this amazing space to recreate, to meet new people, and also, like Scott said, an amazing outlet for mental health. And I think that is real shining star of this conversation.
Thank you both for joining us. Marcia Hovey, president of the Osceola Skate Park Project. Scott May, skateboarder in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ocean temperatures are at record highs. That is the latest from the World Meteorological Organization. We examine the consequences of this global warming and how it could affect life in Wisconsin. You can be part of this discussion, calling in with a question, sharing concerns, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Boyer is an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who specializes in ocean heat. Tim, welcome to the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So scientists have measured record high temperatures in the oceans this year. It's alarming. Can you quantify how much warmer the oceans are now?
Yeah, so sea surface temperature in the ocean in July and August, well, actually every month since May, has been about 0.3 degrees Celsius higher than any year before. And that goes back, to about 1880, the record. And so that doesn't sound like much, 0.3 degrees Celsius, but that's the average over the Northern and Southern Hemisphere. And so right now the Southern Hemisphere is in winter, while the Northern Hemisphere is in summer. So that is a huge difference, a huge increase in temperature in the ocean.
Are the depths and the ocean surface warming at similar rates?
No, the ocean, the sea surface temperature is basically the manifestation of the direct heating from the solar radiation. Mm-hmm. And that heat penetrates deeper into the ocean at a very slow rate. So when you can see large fluctuations, seasonal fluctuations and so on in sea surface temperature, the heat deeper down is usually rising at a steady rate. So the ocean heat content, which is what we call it, we usually think of heat in the ocean in terms of energy, the heat that's absorbed, which of course is manifest in the temperature, but that temperature change is very small. Even at the sea surface, it's 0.3 degrees Celsius. Deeper down, over the last 30 years or so, it's only increased in the top 2,000 meters about 0.2 degrees Celsius, which again doesn't sound like much, but if you take that over the entire ocean volume, that's an immense amount of heat. So just the amount of heat in the last few years, each year that has gone into the ocean is about more than 20 times the entire use of, or the heat energy generated by the entire use of energy by humans per year.
Wow. How are you and fellow scientists able to get accurate, consistent measurements of temperatures in the ocean depths?
So it's actually very difficult to get measurements in the ocean, or it has been. You have to send a ship out and with the proper equipment, and then drop that equipment down to the ocean depths and bring it back to measure the temperature and other ocean variables. And of course, it's difficult to get to to many places in the ocean, and it's difficult. The weather conditions, like going out in winter, can be extremely difficult. But since about 2000, we've had a revolution, a technological revolution, and we have profiling floats in the ocean, the Argo profiling floats, that now we have robotic, these instruments attached to the robotic floats that drift at about 1,000 meters, and every 10 days come to the surface, measuring the temperature to the surface, and send that to satellite. So no longer do we have to rely on ships and weather and the vagaries of the ocean. We have a steady global set of temperatures that that give us the changes in heat in the ocean.
And it sounds like you have this uninterrupted flow of data, of numbers coming in, that would probably be very helpful to you as a scientist.
Yes, it definitely is. The ocean is basically it's the mitigator of energy in the climate system. The ocean covers about it covers more than 70% of the global surface, and its average depth is about 3,800 meters. So it's a huge volume of water. So any excess energy in the Earth system, that means solar radiation coming in and heat radiation going out at the top of the atmosphere, whatever the imbalance there is, about 90% of that is absorbed by the ocean. So if we can measure the change in the heat of the ocean, we can basically understand exactly how much heat energy is being trapped in the Earth system.
Tim Boyer is with us, oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, as we talk about how rapidly warming oceans could affect the world and here in Wisconsin. You can call in with your questions, share comments at 800-642-1234. Tim, are oceans warming faster than other large bodies of water, such as the Great Lakes?
They're not warming faster per se. So the heat uptake by any body of water is going to be dependent on the heat capacity of water. Mm-hmm. And all water has a great capacity to uptake heat. So the Great Lakes would be taking up heat pretty much at the same rate as the ocean. But the Great Lakes are relatively shallow as compared to the ocean. So they're not storing the heat. It's usually the heat in the Great Lakes is usually radiated back out to the atmosphere in fairly short time scales. Whereas in the ocean, the heat is absorbed and it goes down to very deep depths. And as it goes deeper in the ocean, it can take thousands of years for it to come back to the surface. So it's basically storing that heat deeper in the ocean.
Hmm.
As opposed to the Great Lakes, which radiate much of that heat back out to the atmosphere.
I wonder if you can talk about marine heat waves, because NOAA is also tracking and monitoring a really large marine heat wave. What are they?
So marine heat waves are, it's statistical definition based on sea surface temperature. If the water temperature for two or more consecutive days is warmer than 90% of historic temperatures, then that is considered a marine heat wave. So the top 10% of all temperatures ever seen, if that's seen at the sea surface for two or more days, that's considered a marine heat wave.
What happens to marine life as we see these record high temperatures?
Well, that definitely the heat is going to affect. I mean, I think most of us have heard or aware of coral bleaching. The higher temperatures affect and stress coral reefs, and the longer those temperatures are in effect, the more stress on the coral reefs. Now, other ocean life, the basic base of the food chain, the plankton in the ocean can be very susceptible to temperature changes. So there can be a lot of stress on that plankton. And what you see as these marine heat waves become more common, or as the the mean temperature of the ocean changes is you have, say, a northward migration of these plankton that can no longer survive or thrive, I should say, in the higher heat. They will move northward and then to cooler water. And then the marine life that depends upon them will also move. And so you have complete changes in the ecosystem and in fisheries.
It's like climate migration for oceans almost.
Yes, yeah. It's exactly, yes.
We heard from Elizabeth in Verona, called in, and Elizabeth is thinking about having a child soon, but seeing ocean temperatures rise so sharply is making Elizabeth rethink their plans to start a family. And they're even considering moving further north due to the threat of climate change. How should we take this information about the oceans and apply it to our personal lives?
So the ocean is the buffer of the Earth's climate system. And I actually take heart in that the ocean, the heat in the ocean has been increasing pretty steadily. Now the sea surface temperature, the marine heat waves, that which we're seeing, which is making news right now, those are fluctuations. And to be honest, they're pretty scary fluctuations, the high temperatures we're seeing now. But we can rely on the ocean to some extent in the long term to be a buffer. These short-term changes, these high heat events in the ocean, are just the surface manifestation, and the more steady the longer term, the ocean will absorb and continue to absorb a lot of the heat, the excess heat in the atmosphere, and be that buffer for the Earth system for a long time to come. Now, there are changes, of course. As more heat comes in at the surface, the ocean tends to become more stratified, meaning that the warmer water tends to stay near the surface, where the cooler water is down below. So it takes more energy for that heat to penetrate. It stays closer to the surface and has less of a mitigating effect on the sea surface temperatures or atmospheric temperatures. And so we do have to look at that. I'm sorry, this is kind of a long answer to get around to.
Appreciate you.
I am reassured
the time
by the ocean being a buffer for the changes that we are seeing. But at the same time, its capacity to be that buffer is lessening over time.
Let's just
I'm not going to give advice to someone about their choices, but I do have confidence that the ocean will help mitigate the changes that are coming in the future.
That is oceanographer Tim Boyer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration explaining what could happen as the oceans of the world hit record high temperatures. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share concerns at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As oceans have never been warmer, we learn about the serious consequences for life around them, what it means for Wisconsin communities. You can enter this conversation, call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Oceanographer Tim Boyer is at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Tim, Wisconsin being more than 1,000 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, our state about 2,000 miles from the Pacific, is Wisconsin insulated from the effects of warming ocean?
No, not completely. Definitely there are effects of warming oceans that aren't affecting Wisconsin, such as sea level rise as the ocean warms and water expands and sea level rises, that's not going to directly affect Wisconsin. But the ocean is directly affects weather patterns globally. And right now we are in an El Nino period, which is warmer temperatures in the upper ocean in the Eastern Pacific, Equatorial Pacific, which have a great effect globally on temperatures and precipitation patterns. And so the effect from El Nino currently in Wisconsin would be, I mean, the expected effect, I should say, is warmer temperatures over the entire northern United States. And of course, the long-term ocean warming, the ocean again is the mitigator of the Earth's climate system, but it can only mitigate so much. And so long-term, the sea surface temperature and the atmospheric temperature are going to rise.
Do you know, do scientists know, is there a limit to how much heat the oceans can absorb?
Yeah. I mean, it's a vast body of water. And right now at the ocean depths, near the bottom, the temperature is close to freezing. And that water has been there, won't cycle to the surface for thousands of years. So that there is a great capacity to uptake heat. It's more that as the near surface warms, as I was describing in the answer to the question before, the ocean is going to become more stratified because the heat is all coming, the warming is all occurring at the surface, and it is circulating throughout the ocean. But as the surface warms more and the cold, there's warm water up in the upper ocean and colder water deeper down, the ocean becomes more stratified, and the ability what that affects is the circulation. There's less ability for the water to go deeper down, so it stays near the surface, and that water, the heat in that water will radiate back out to the atmosphere, and there's less capacity to uptake heat. So the ocean doesn't have, there's not so much a limit on the ability, the capacity for the ocean to uptake heat, but the conditions are changing, and less heat will enter the ocean, or will be radiated back out into the atmosphere.
As you discuss changing conditions, Paul in Chippewa Falls called in, and Paul was taught in school that glaciers have affected Wisconsin and the Midwest for centuries, and is wondering, how is what's happening now with the oceans different from what's happened hundreds and thousands of years ago?
Different now. The uptake of heat, well, I'm not a paleoceanographer, but the ocean has seen increases and decreases in heat based on the paleoclimatological record, but our modern record is basically limited to about 1880 to present. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen in that period is that over the last 20 years or so, the increase in ocean heat has been pretty steady and much larger than in earlier time periods. Now, we don't have that long of a record, but it does appear, at least in the modern record, that the ocean heat is increasing at a rate much larger than it was earlier in the modern record.
Tim Boyer is an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. As we discuss rapidly warming oceans and their effects, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff is here from Waterloo, Wisconsin. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I read in a journal a few years ago that there are some long cycle currents in the ocean, at least the Atlantic, where the polar currents, the cold water sinks, flows to the equator and then rises, and it takes like 50 years for this cycle in the Atlantic. And I was wondering, is that true or accurate? And is there also a cycle in the Pacific?
Jeff, thanks for that question. Tim, can you help us out here with long cycle ocean currents?
Yeah, that's the overturning circulation. And the one you're referring to, or at least first, is the North Atlantic, the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. And that's basically the heat. So the ocean heats is going to heat more at the equator than it is at higher latitudes. And that water is moved to the north in the Gulf Stream. So that very warm water comes through the Gulf Stream and up into the northern latitudes. And that's a big transfer of heat from the south to the north. And then that water cools, the water in the north cools, and it sinks because it's very dense. So it sinks, and then it comes back south in the undercurrents. And so very cold water comes south at depth in the ocean. And this cycle is continuous. And the possibility, and what we've seen, and this deals more with the ocean's freshwater cycle, although it is also related to the heat cycle, is that if the water in the high north becomes, in the high latitudes, becomes very fresh and less dense due to melt of the glaciers up there, then the water doesn't sink and doesn't come south again, and that kind of shuts down the overturning circulation, and all that heat in the Gulf Stream stays to the south. Now, this hasn't happened, and we don't see any real evidence that this circulation has slowed down, but that is a possibility.
In our last moments together, in your research at NOAA, what are you trying to understand about the oceans now?
We're trying to understand ocean circulation changes due to the changes in heat and fresh water, how that affects changes in ocean circulation, such as I just described. And I didn't fully answer the question. That does happen in the Pacific, but to a lesser extent. And how then these changes in the ocean affect the Earth's climate.
Do you feel that there is hope that we will be able to get oceans back to a normal temperature at some point?
Well, oceans back to a normal temperature. Well, that heat is pretty well sequestered in the ocean. Mm. I don't necessarily see a reversal of the increasing heat in the ocean.
Okay.
But my hope is that the ocean is such a buffer for the Earth system that even as the energy in the Earth system increases, the ocean increases as a buffer to that system. That doesn't mean that we won't see the effects, but that the effects are mitigated by the ocean. And so that gives me hope.
Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tim Boyer is an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, specializing in ocean heat. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.